Session number 10203, Reel 4.
Mr. Nunnally, Reel 4.
Silly to throw one's life away for little more than perhaps interested curiosity of no great military value. I should have had an escort with me. I should have taken some troops. My realization I was being rather stupid was reinforced by the fact that we had in another unit a very gallant major who decided that he would go and look for the enemy, and he disguised himself as a Burmese and left his unit's positions never to be seen again. I think quite a number of casualties was caused by an understandable inexperience coupled with somewhat misplaced military zeal, as opposed to being coldly efficient, if you see what I mean. This chap didn't have to go out disguised. He could perfectly well have taken a reconnaissance patrol or a fighting patrol, but I suppose he had some ideas that he could make a valuable contribution. He lost his life.
You were talking about the procedure for handling prisoners, but were you taking any Japanese prisoners?
Not many. We took some prisoners who were quite beyond fighting because they were starving. You see, the point was that the Japanese army didn't have a formal rationing procedure in that particular campaign. They had to rely on living off the land. And when their attack on the gateway of India failed at Kohima and Imphal, and they fell back, starvation was rife, and it was, as I said, commonplace to see bodies of soldiers who had just died lying by the track or lying in huts called bashes, their bodies bloated beyond belief, filled with internal gases. At the same time, you'd also see skeletons by the hundreds, uniformed skeletons. You'd see men who had obviously, as comrades, lain down side by side and died together, possibly sharing a hand grenade to blow themselves up in some cases, or perhaps for all I know dispatching the other to put them out of their misery. You'd see abandoned trucks and staff cars all pointing north, that is to say towards India, and soldiers had crawled into the cabs of these trucks, which were bogged down and probably no fuel anyway, and they simply died in the cabs of the trucks. It was a horrendous scene down the Khabur Valley from Tarmu southwards, which has been chronicled at great length. And I saw quite enough of it to be shocked by the magnitude of the suffering that the Japanese army had experienced. I was with a Major Onslow. We were advancing. He was a company commander, and in my capacity as intelligence officer, I was accompanying him as he spearheaded the advance of the battalion at that particular point down the Khabur Valley, and we entered a village where there was the mandatory statue of Buddha in a corrugated iron roofed shrine. There was a Japanese lying at the foot of the Buddha, a skeleton, you might say, a living skeleton, almost naked, and we put him on a stretcher and sent him back. I didn't hear anything more about it until I read the book Monsoon Victory by Gerald Hanley, where it transpired that this unfortunate Japanese, suffering from beriberi and starvation and probably malaria, had been in delirium when they got him back to medical attention, and his ravings were chronicled in this book. Which I've got here. This was a Japanese officer whose name was Captain Mitsuo something or other. He was a regular officer, and he was very far gone indeed. But his ravings were described as an expression of his attitude to his own troops and to life in general. He raved all night, it's recorded, screaming and shouting, "Lieutenant Hazaki! Lieutenant Hazaki! Where are you, you bastard? Shoot me with your pistol! Come and shoot me, you useless fool! For the sake of the Emperor, we came to these filthy hills to be disgraced, dragged on my behind by blackamoors. We came from Indochina to be disgraced and clowned by blackamoors. Lieutenant Hazaki, you bastard, bring a machine gun and mow them down. Our useless bloody soldiers. Hazaki, turn the machine gun on those useless Japanese soldiers. Oh, the disgrace. A Japanese officer dragged in the mud. Hey, you there, Hazaki. Shoot me. Shoot me! God save the Emperor! Tenno Heike Banzai! Koroshito Kure! Shoot me! Quite an illustrating story, isn't it?
Indeed. I've read or heard somebody say, who was in Burma, that if the Japanese troops were in our army, practically all of them would get VCs. Do you think that's an accurate description from your own personal experience?
It's a very interesting thought. Of course, fanaticism is the guiding consideration of the Japanese soldier and sailor and airman, I suppose. Certainly a willingness, a readiness, a desire to throw away one's life is not quite so common amongst Europeans, is it?
But you found that they would fight to the death, would you?
Oh, absolutely. Nor would I personally have liked to have been taken prisoner by the Japanese, because they regarded one who had been taken prisoner as being a traitor to his country and unworthy. So if that is their attitude, they die for the sake of the Emperor. We try to preserve our lives.
Can you describe to me the actual handling of a particular Japanese prisoner that you remember? the interrogation and so on, and what you found out, how it was conducted?
No, I can't, because it was not part of my duty to, not being a Japanese speaker, I simply processed the any prisoners that we did take by getting them back. I took off the bodies, as I said, their documents, insignia, to find out their units and formations and so forth, which I then parceled up and sent back to brigade headquarters, who doubtless then the brigade intelligence officers passed relevant information back to divisional and so on, where there were Japanese speakers and intelligence officers and so forth. Now, the role of the battalion intelligence officer is of a much more practical nature.
What type of material would you take from bodies?
You would take their paybook. You would take any documents and letters and photographs of their families that you could find. Many, 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 if not the overwhelming majority of Japanese soldiers carried a silk flag of the rising sun, the white background and the orange sun, and indeed I have such a flag myself here, radiating from the edge of the rising sun are messages painted in black ink from members of their family and their friends wishing them good luck in their fight for the emperor. So the whole flag would be decorated with these messages, like the spokes of a wheel. Now, of course, that could provide valuable information as to the formation that the soldier belonged to. They were great diary keepers as well, so you would find that sort of thing. Many had very pornographic photographs on them, and I did think it was rather bizarre. On one occasion I went into one of these huts or bashes where there were some Japanese lying on the makeshift beds. They'd only just died, and in the hand of one of them was a really dirty photograph. Now, one would have imagined that physically and mentally the thought of pornography would have been the last in their minds, but it was commonplace. Anyway, one sent back, as I said, badges of rank, anything you could find on the body for scrutiny and examination by those more qualified in the language and the formations.
I think the flag you mentioned from the fall of Singapore is worth describing in words.
Yes, I think it is an interesting story. On the 15th of February 1942, Singapore surrendered. A unit of the Japanese army, which I believe to be 215 Infantry Regiment, was in Singapore at the capitulation. Flying from an official building was a large Union Jack, 3 yards wide, and my conjecture is that a burst of automatic fire was put through the flag as it flew from a mast, that it was then lowered, and certainly when it was lowered, it was laid on the ground, and in bold Japanese characters in black paint was painted the following legend. commemorating the fall of Singapore, 15th of February 1942, Sergeant Major Uchiyama. To have in one's possession an important flag of an enemy nation obviously meant a great deal to the Japanese, and Sergeant Major Uchiyama would have carried this flag in his pack from the fall of Singapore until the Burma campaign. It came into my possession following an attack on the 5th of November 1944 in the Kabul Valley, when a number of Japanese were killed and the flag was found in a pack belonging to a dead soldier. The 3rd Sixth suffered serious casualties in that attack, and the flag was variously used after we'd recovered it as a sheet to keep us comfortable at night, as a blanket when it was cold, and then I felt that it was such a trophy of war that it deserved a better fate, and so I have kept it all these years.
Once you were in Burma, how much contact did you have with Japanese Indian forces, the so-called Indian National Army?
Initially, quite a good deal. Subhas Chandra Bose had inspired the formation of what became known as the Indian National Army. I'm not a historian, so I may get some of the nomenclature and terms slightly wrong, but it was the Indian National Army, and there were several so-called brigades within the Indian National Army, one of which was the Azad Brigade, A-Z-A-D. The Indian National Army comprised Indian Army troops who had been taken prisoner or who had deserted and had been encouraged to join this force. It appeared to be pretty undisciplined, but was obviously very important as a proclamation by Subhas Chandra Bose of his aspirations towards the future of India. The 3rd 6th KAR, in advancing down the Kabul Valley, made a number of dawn attacks on villages to east and west of the axis of advance, and on one occasion the second in command of the battalion, Major Marsh, was leading a company attack, and as intelligence officer I accompanied him. Called for a night march, which I can assure you is no easy achievement in the monsoon and in the mud, and we stumbled and cursed miles upon miles across country to get into position for a dawn attack on the village of Sunle, S-U-N-L-E, and we attacked. There were some Japanese in the village, and we took something like 30 INA prisoners who we herded back to battalion. They were pretty far gone in terms of endurance because they were as short of food as the Japanese soldiers at that time were. So they were only too ready to give themselves up. They didn't display very much fighting spirit. Surliness and bloody-mindedness, but not a fighting spirit. Otherwise they wouldn't have surrendered so easily. Admittedly, you're not at your best if you're the victim of a dawn attack, it must be said. But there were Koreans amongst them. There were Sikhs and other Indian races. One Gurkha, I remember, in that particular batch of prisoners. We found amongst them all manner of documents, like the nominal roll of the brigade. Now, brigade in our terms, the British Army terms at that time, was three battalions, each of around 1,000 men, with all the accompanying arms and services. The Azad Brigade might have measured about one battalion in total numbers, with no evidence at all of supporting arms, artillery and so forth, which presumably lay completely within the control of the Japanese, to whom the INA was attached. They were a motley crew, therefore. Nonetheless, I don't think any of us would have relished the prospect of being taken prisoner by them, because they would have undoubtedly dispatched one, because their future was so uncertain as traitors to the British that presumably they wouldn't have wanted anybody alive who could give evidence subsequently against them. So I wouldn't have trusted them an inch. These prisoners were consigned back through the normal chain, brigade, division and corps and wherever they finally went, where their political significance would have been properly assessed. I guess that they were given sentences which were fairly quickly commuted after the war as a political expedient. So, yes, we did find ourselves nominally opposed to them, but not in formal set-piece actions.
And the Japanese had put Koreans in with the Indian
units,
had they?
Well, it was just a polyglot bunch of all types. They were just told, you are the Azad Brigade, and rather like I was saying about the different tribes, you can say, so making up the KAR battalions, so you might say that these different races that formed the INA were just, as an accident of formation, put together.
Was there any tendency, do you know, of the British tactical planners to attack where there were INA units rather than Japanese units?
No, I don't think that would have been feasible, because the INA was part and parcel in that particular area of the Japanese forces. I guess they were there to demonstrate to the Indians in India, when the Japanese made their way to Imphal and Kohima with the later intention of invading India, they would have demonstrated to the Indian population that the Japanese came as liberators, assisted by the patriotic Indian National Army.
Did you see much of the Burmese civilians?
Yes, a great deal. I personally never experienced treachery on their part, although it is documented in various places that there were plenty of anti-British Burmese who saw the British as a colonial oppressor and who welcomed the Japanese as liberators. And it must be remembered that the Japanese plastered every village in Burma with leaflets and posters proclaiming the Southeast Asia co-prosperity sphere, which encouraged that element amongst the Burmese population to see the Japanese as liberators from colonial oppression. But in the ordinary situation of the Burmese village, what, in my experience, and of course I can only speak from a very narrow standpoint of my own experience, when we went to a village, we did our best to distribute food and to give medicines and bandages and the like to the villagers who were suffering from various injuries through malnutrition or whatever, yaws, for example. And we always had quite a queue of people, both sexes, all ages, in need of medical attention, which we were very happy to give. I mean, there's no reason why we shouldn't, and we had the resources to do so. So I personally never saw any evidence of anti-Britishness. I saw pleasure on their faces when we arrived. I think we did our best to alleviate to some small degree their misfortunes physically and in terms of nutrition within our own relatively limited resources.
Were they all actual Burmans, or were there any of the other peoples in your particular part?
They were Burmans.
Can you describe fairly chronologically the actual combat actions you took part in?
Yes. Well, I mentioned first of all that when we were spearheading as the leading battalion this slow monsoon advance down the Khabur Valley, we were making dawn attacks on the villages to east and west of the north-south track. We attacked after Sunli, we attacked Witok, W-I-T-O-K, again under Major Marsh. And I did see the most extraordinary thing there. There was a rattle of fire when we attacked. Very few Japanese there. Some escaped. Others were killed. And for the first time in my life, I saw a dead man standing completely upright with one shoulder resting against a bamboo fence.